General Meifert leaned toward Rika. You cut her throat? You didn't use your Agile? Rika gave him a look that suggested she thought he hadn't been paying attention. Like the prelate said, an Agile doesn't work very well on those the Dreamwalker controls, so I used a knife. Dreamwalker or not, cutting her throat worked just fine. Rika lifted the head before Averna again. One of the reports stuck to the bottom of it as it swung by the hair. I sliced the knife through her throat and around her neck. She was thrashing about quite a bit, so I had a good hold on her as she died. All of a sudden, there was an instant when the whole world went black, and I mean black, black as the Keeper's heart. It was as if the underworld had suddenly taken us all. Verna looked away from the head of a sister she had known for a very long time, and had always believed was devoted to the Creator, to the light of life. She had been devoted instead to death. The Keeper came to claim one of his own, Verna explained in a quiet voice. Well, Rika said, rather sarcastically, Verna thought. I didn't think that when a sister of the light died, such a thing happened. I told you it was a sister of the dark. Verna nodded. So you did. General Meifert gave the Mord Sith a hurried clap on the back of the shoulder. Thanks, Rika. I'd better spread the word. If Jigang is starting to move, it won't be many days before he's here. We need to be sure the passes are ready when his force finally gets here. The passes will hold, Verna said. She let out a silent sigh. At least for a while. The Order had to come across the mountains if they were to conquer Dahara. There were few ways across those formidable mountains. Verna and the sisters had shielded and sealed those passes as well as it was possible to seal them. They had used magic to bring down walls of rock in places, making the narrow roads impassable. In other places, they had used their power to cleave away roads cut into the steep sides of mountains, leaving no way through except to clamber over rubble. To prevent that, and in other places, the men had worked all winter constructing stone walls across the passes. Atop those walls were fortifications from which they could rain down death on the narrow passes below. Additionally, in every one of those places, the sisters had set snares of magic so deadly that coming through would be a bloody ordeal that would only get worse. And that was before they encountered the walls lined with defenders. Jigang had Sisters of the Dark to try to undo the barriers of both magic and stone, but Verna was more powerful, in the additive anyway, than any of them. Besides that, she had joined her power with other sisters in order to invest in those barriers magic she knew would prove formidable. Still, Jigang would come. Nothing Verna, her sisters, and the Daharan army could do would ultimately be able to withstand the numbers Jigang would throw at them. If he had to command his men to march through passes filled 100 feet deep with their fallen comrades, he would not flinch from doing so. Nor would it matter to him if the corpses were 1,000 feet deep. I'll be back a little later, Verna, the general said. We'll need to get the officers and some of the sisters together and make sure everything is ready. Yes, of course, Verna said. Both General Meifert and Rika started to leave. Rika, Verna called. She gestured down at the desk. Take the dear departed sister with you, would you please? Rika sighed, which nearly spilled her bosom out of the dress. She made a long-suffering face before snatching up the head and vanishing out of the tent behind the general. Verna sat down and put her head in her hands. It was going to start all over again. It had been a long and peaceful, if bitterly cold, winter. Jigang had made his winter encampment on the other side of the mountains, far enough away that, with the snow and cold, it was difficult to launch effective raids against his troops. Just as it had the summer before the Summer Warren had died, now that the weather was favorable, the Order would begin to move. It was starting all over again, the killing, the terror, the fighting, running, hunger, exhaustion. But what choice was there, other than to be killed? In many ways, life had come to seem worse than death. Verna abruptly remembered, then, about the journey book. She worked it out of the pocket in her belt and pulled the lamp closer, needing the comfort as well as the light. She wondered where Richard and Kaelin were, if they were safe, and she thought, too, about Zed and Addie, all alone, guarding the wizard's keep. Unlike everyone else, at least Zed and Addie were safe and at peace where they were, for the time being anyway. Sooner or later, Dahara would fall, and then Jagang would return to Adendril. Verna tossed the small black book on the desk, smoothed her dress beneath her legs, and scooted her chair closer. She ran her fingers over the familiar leather cover on an object of magic that was over 3,000 years old. The journey books had been invested with magic by those mysterious wizards who so long ago had built the Palace of the Prophets. A journey book was twinned, and as such, they were priceless. What was written in one appeared at the same time in its twin. In that way, the sisters could communicate over vast distances and know important information as it happened, rather than weeks or even months later. Anne, the real prelate, had the twin to Verna's. Verna herself had been sent by Anne on a journey of nearly 20 years to find Richard. Anne had known all along where Richard had been. It was for that reason that Verna could understand Kaelin's rage at how Anne had seemed to twist her and Richard's life. But Verna had come to understand that the prelate had sent her on what was actually a mission of vital importance, one that had brought change to the world, but also brought hope for the future. Verna opened the journey book, holding it a little sideways to see the words in the light. "Verna," Anne wrote, "I believe I have discovered where the prophet is hiding." Verna sat back in surprise. After the palace had been destroyed, Nathan the prophet had escaped their control and had since been roaming free, a profound danger. For the last couple of years, the rest of the Sisters of the Light had believed that the prelate and the prophet were dead. Anne, when she'd left the Palace of the Prophets with Nathan on an important mission, had feigned their death and named Verna prelate to succeed her. Very few people other than Verna, Zed, Richard, and Kaelin knew the truth. During that mission, however, Nathan had managed to get his collar off and escape Anne's control. There was no telling what catastrophe that man could cause. Verna leaned over the journey book again. "I should have Nathan within days now. I can hardly believe that after all this time I nearly have my hands on that man. I will let you know soon. How are you, Verna? How are you feeling? How are the sisters and how go matters with the army? Write when you can. I will be checking my journey book nightly. I miss you terribly." Verna sat back again. That was all there was, but it was enough. The very notion of Anne finally capturing Nathan made Verna's head swim with relief. Even that momentous news, though, failed to do much to lift her mood. Jagang was about to launch his attack on Dahara, and Anne was about to finally have Nathan under control, but Richard was somewhere off to the south, beyond their control. Anne had worked for 500 years to shape events so that Richard could lead them in the battle for the future of mankind, and now, on the eve of what could very well prove to be that final battle, he was not there with them. Verna drew the stylus out of the journey book's spine and leaned over to write Anne a report. "My dearest Anne, I'm afraid that things here are about to become very unpleasant. The siege of the passes into Dahara is about to begin." Chapter 20. The sprawling corridors of the People's Palace, seat of power in Dahara, were filled with the whisper of footsteps on stone. Anne pushed herself back a little on the white marble bench where she sat stuffed between three women on one side and an older couple on the other, all gossiping about what people were wearing as they strolled the grand halls, or what other people did while they were here, or what they most wanted to see. Anne supposed that such gossip was harmless enough and probably meant to take people's minds off the worries of the war. Still, it was hard to believe that at such a late hour people would rather be out gossiping than in a warm bed asleep. Anne kept her head down and pretended to be pawing through her travel bag, while at the same time keeping a wary eye on the soldiers passing not too far away as they patrolled. She didn't know if her caution was necessary, but she would rather not find out too late that it was.
"Come from far?" the closest woman beside her asked.
Anne looked up, realizing that the woman had spoken to her.
"Well, yes, I guess it has been a bit of a journey."
Anne put her nose back in her bag and rummaged in earnest, hoping to be left alone. The woman, middle-aged, with her curls of brown hair just starting to carry a bit of gray, smiled.
I'm not all that far from home myself, but I do like to spend a night at the palace now and then just to lift my spirits.
Anne glanced around at the polished marble floors, the glossy red stone columns below arches, decorated with carved vines that supported the upper balconies. She gazed up at the skylights that allowed the light to flood in the place during the day, and peered off at the grand statues that stood on pedestals around a fountain with life-size stone horses galloping forever through a shimmering spray of water.
"Yes, I see what you mean," Anne murmured.
The place didn't lift her spirits. In fact, the place made her as nervous as a cat in a doghouse with the door closed. She could feel that her power was frighteningly diminished in this place. The People's Palace was more than any mere palace. It was a city all joined together and under countless roofs atop a huge plateau. Tens of thousands of people lived in the magnificent structure, and thousands more visited it daily. There were different levels to the palace itself. Some where people had shops and sold goods, others where officials worked, some that were living quarters. Many sections were off-limits to those who visited. Sprawled around the base of the plateau were informal markets where people gathered to buy, sell, and trade goods. On the climb all the way up through the interior of the plateau to reach the palace itself, Anne had passed many permanent shops. The palace was a center of trade, drawing people from all over Dahara. More than that, though, it was the ancestral home of the House of Rawl. As such, it was grand for arcane reasons beyond the awareness or even understanding of most of the people who called it home or visited it. The People's Palace was a spell, not a place spelled, as had been the Palace of the Prophets where Anne had spent most of her life. The place itself was the spell. The entire palace had been built to a careful and precise design, that of a spell drawn on the face of the ground. The outer fortified walls contained the actual spell form, and the major congregations of rooms formed significant hubs, while the halls and corridors themselves were the drawn lines, the essence of the spell itself, the power. Like a spell being drawn in the dirt with the point of a stick, the halls would have had to have been built in the sequence required by the specific magic the spell was intended to invoke. It would have been enormously expensive to build it in that manner, ignoring the typical requirements of construction and accepted methods of the trade of building. But only by doing so would the spell work, and work it did. The spell was specific. It was a place of safety for any Rawl. It was meant to give a Rawl more power in the place, and to leech power away from anyone else who entered. Anne had never been in a place where she felt such a waning of her Han, the essence of life and the gift within. She doubted that in this place her Han would for long be vital enough to light a candle. Anne's jaw dropped in astonishment as another element of the spell abruptly occurred to her. She looked out at the halls, part of the lines of the spell, filled with people. Spells drawn with blood were always more effective and powerful. But when the blood soaked into the ground, decomposed, and dissipated, the power of the spell would often fade as well. But this spell, the drawn lines of the spell itself, the corridors, were filled with the vital living blood of all the people moving through them. Anne was struck dumb with awe at such a brilliant concept.
"So, you're renting a room, then?"
Anne had forgotten the woman beside her, still staring at her, still holding the smile on her painted lips. Anne forced herself to close her mouth.
"Well,"
Anne finally admitted, "I haven't actually made arrangements yet as to where I will sleep." The woman's smile persisted, but it looked as if it was taking more and more effort all the time.
"You can't curl up on a bench, you know. The guards won't allow it. You have to rent a room or be put out at night."
Anne understood then what the woman was driving at. To these people, most dressed in their finest clothes for their visit to the palace, Anne must look like a beggar in their midst. After all the gossip about what people were wearing, this woman must have been disconcerted to find herself beside Anne.
"I have the price of a room," Anne assured her. "I just haven't found where they are yet, that's all. After such a long journey, I meant to go there right away and get myself cleaned up, but I just needed to rest my weary feet for a bit first. Could you tell me where to find the rooms to rent?"
The smile looked a little easier.
"I'm off to my own room, and I could take you. It isn't far." That would be kind of you, Anne said as she rose now that she saw the guards moving off down the corridor. The woman stood, bidding her two benchmates a good night. If Anne was tired, it was only from being caught up in the afternoon devotion to the Lord Rawl. A bell in an open square had tolled, and everyone had moved together there and bowed down. Anne had noticed then that no one missed the devotion. Guards moved among the crowd, watching people gather. She felt like a mouse being watched by hawks, so she joined with the other people moving toward the square. She had spent nearly 2 hours on her knees on a hard clay tile floor, bowed down with her forehead touching the ground like everyone else, repeating the devotion in concert with all the other somber voices. Master Rawl, guide us. Master Rawl, teach us. Master Rawl, protect us. In your light we thrive. In your mercy we are sheltered. In your wisdom we are humbled. We live only to serve. Our lives are yours. Twice a day, those in the palace were expected to go to the devotion. Anne didn't know how people endured such torture. Then she remembered the bond between the Lord Rawl and his people that prevented the Dreamwalker from entering their minds, and she knew how they could endure it. She herself had briefly been a prisoner of Emperor Jagang. He murdered his sister right before her eyes, just to make a point. In the face of brutality and torture, she guessed that she knew how people endured a mere devotion. For her, though, such a spoken devotion to the Lord Rawl, to Richard, was hardly necessary. She had been devoted to him for nearly 500 years before he had even been born. Prophecy said that Richard was their only chance to avoid catastrophe. Anne peered carefully around the halls. Now she just needed the prophet himself. "This way," the woman said, tugging at Anne's sleeve. The woman gestured for Anne to follow her down a hallway to the right. Anne pulled her shawl forward, covering the pack she carried, and hugged her travel bag closer as she followed along the wide corridor. She wondered how many people sitting on benches and low marble walls around fountains were gossiping about her. The floor had a dizzying pattern of dark brown, rust, and pale tan-colored stone running across the hall in zigzag lines meant to look three-dimensional. Anne had seen such traditional patterns before, down in the old world, but none of this grand scale. It was a work of art, and it was but the floor. Everything about the palace was exquisite. Shops were set back under a mezzanine to each side. Some of them looked to sell items travelers might want. There was a variety of small food and drink stands, everything from hot meat pies to sweets to ale to warm milk. Some places sold nightclothes. Others sold hair ribbons. Even at this late hour, some of the shops were still open and doing brisk business. In a place such as this, there would be people who worked at night and would have need of such shops. The places that offered to do up a woman's hair or paint her face or promised to do wonders with her fingernails were all closed until morning. Anne doubted they could pull off wonders with her. The woman cleared her throat as they strolled down the broad corridor, gazing at the shops to each side. "Where have you traveled from?" "Oh, far to the south. Very far." Anne took note of the woman's focused attention as she leaned in a bit. "My sister lives here," Anne said, giving the woman something more to chew on. "I'm here to visit my sister. She advises Lord Rawl on important matters." The woman's eyebrows lifted. "Really? An advisor to Lord Rawl himself? What an honor for your family." "Yes," Anne drawled. "We're all proud of her." "What does she advise him on?" "Advise him on? Oh, well, matters of war." The woman's mouth fell open. "A woman? Advising Lord Rawl on warfare?" "Oh, yes," Anne insisted. She leaned over and whispered. "She's a sorceress. Sees into the future, you know. Why, she wrote me a letter and told me she saw me coming to the palace for a visit. Isn't that amazing?" The woman frowned a bit. "Well, that does seem rather remarkable, since here you are and all." "Yes, and she told me that I'd meet a helpful woman." The woman's smile returned. It again looked forced. "She sounds to be quite talented." "Oh, you have no idea," Anne insisted. She is so specific in her forecasts about the future. Really? Had she anything else to say about your visit then? Anything specific? Oh, yes, indeed. Why, do you know that she told me I would meet a man when I came here?
The woman's gaze flicked around the halls.
Well, there are a lot of men here. That hardly seems very specific. Surely she must have said more than that. I mean, if she's so talented and an advisor to Lord Rawl and all.
Anne put a finger to her lip, frowning in feigned effort at recollection.
Why, yes, she did, now that you mention it. Let's see if I can remember.
Anne laid a hand on the woman's arm in a familiar manner.
She tells me about my future all the time. My sister is always telling me so many things about my future in her letters that I sometimes feel as if I'm having trouble catching up with my own life. I sometimes have trouble remembering it all.
Oh, do try, the woman said, eager for gossip.
This is so fascinating.
Anne returned the finger to her lower lip as she gazed at the ceiling, pretending to be engaged in deep thought, and noticed for the first time that the ceiling was painted like the sky, with clouds and all. The effect was quite clever.
Well, Anne finally said, when she was sure she had the woman's full attention, my sister said that the man I would meet was old.
She returned the hand to the woman's arm.
But very distinguished. Not old and decrepit, but tall, very tall, with a full head of white hair that comes all the way down to his broad shoulders. She said that he would be clean-shaven, and that he would be ruggedly handsome, with penetrating dark azure eyes.
Dark azure eyes, my, the woman tittered.
But he does sound handsome.
And she said that when he looks at a woman with those hawk-like eyes of his, their knees want to buckle.
That is precise, the woman said, her face getting flushed.
Too bad she didn't know this handsome fellow's name.
Oh, but she did. What kind of advisor to the Lord Rawl would she be if she wasn't talented enough to know such things?
She told you his name, too? She can really do such tellings of the future?
Oh, my, yes, Anne assured her.
She strolled along for a time, watching people making their way up and down the hall, stopping at some of the shops that were still open or sitting on benches gossiping.
And, the woman asked, what is the name your sister foretold, the name of this tall, distinguished gentleman?
Anne frowned up at the ceiling again.
It was N something, Nigel or Norris or something.
No, wait, that wasn't it.
Anne snapped her fingers and thumb. The name she said was Nathan.
Nathan, the woman repeated, looking almost as if she had been ready to pluck the name off Anne's tongue if she didn't spit it out.
Nathan.
Yes, that's it, Nathan. Do you know anyone here at the palace by that name? Nathan? A tall fellow, older, with long white hair, broad shoulders, azure eyes?
The woman peered up at the ceiling and thought. This time it was Anne leaning in, waiting for a word, watching intently for any reaction.
A hand seized Anne's dress at her shoulder and brought her to an abrupt halt.
Anne and the woman turned. Behind them stood a very tall woman with a very long blonde braid, with very blue eyes, wearing a very dark scowl and an outfit of very red leather.
The woman beside Anne went as pale as vanilla pudding. Her mouth fell open. Anne forced her own mouth to stay shut.
We've been expecting you, the woman in red leather said.
Behind her, back up the hallway a short distance, spread out to block the hall, stood a dozen perfectly huge men in perfect leather armor carrying perfectly polished swords, knives, and lances.
Why, I think you must have me mistaken for I don't make mistakes.
Anne wasn't nearly as tall as the blonde woman in red leather. She hardly came up past the yellow crescent and star across her stomach.
No, I don't suppose you do. What's this about? Anne asked, losing the timid, innocent tone.
Wizard Rawl wanted us to bring you in.
Wizard Rawl?
Yes, Wizard Nathan Rawl.
Anne heard a gasp from the woman beside her. She thought the woman was going to faint, so she took hold of her arm.
Are you all right, my dear?
She stared wide-eyed at the woman in red leather, glowering down at her. Yes, I have to go. I'm late. I must go. Can I go?
Yes, you had better go, the tall blonde said. The woman dipped a quick bow and muttered, good night, before scurrying off down the hall, looking over her shoulder only once. Anne turned back to the scowl.
Well, I'm glad you found me. Let's be off to see Nathan.
Excuse me, Wizard Rawl.
You won't be having an audience with Wizard Rawl.
You mean not tonight? I won't be having an audience with him tonight.
Anne was being as polite as she could be, but she wanted to clobber that troublesome man or wring his neck, and the sooner the better.
My name is Nida, the woman said. Pleased to meet you. Do you know what I am?
She didn't wait for Anne to answer. I am Mord Sith. I give you this one warning as a courtesy. It is the only warning or courtesy you will receive, so listen closely. You came here with hostile intent against Wizard Rawl. You are now my prisoner. Use of your magic against a Mord Sith will result in the capture of that magic by me or one of my sister Mord Sith, and its use as a weapon against you. A very, very unpleasant weapon.
Well, Anne said, in this place my magic is not very useful, I'm afraid. Hardly worth a hoot, as a matter of fact. So you see, I'm quite harmless.
I don't care how useful you find your magic. If you try to so much as light a candle with it, your power will be mine.
I see, Anne said.
Don't believe me?
Nida leaned down. I encourage you to try to attack me. I haven't captured a sorcerer's magic for quite a while. Might be fun.
Thank you, but I'm a bit too tired out, from my travels and all, to be attacking anyone just now. Maybe later.
Nida smiled. In that smile, Anne could see why Mord Sith were so feared.
Fine. Later, then.
So, what is it you intend to do with me in the meantime, Nida? Put me up in one of the palace's fine rooms?
Nida ignored the question and gestured with a tilt of her head. Two of the men a short way back up the hall rushed forward. They towered over Anne like two oak trees. Each grabbed her under an arm.
Let's go, Nida said as she marched off down the hall ahead of them. The men started out after her, pulling Anne along with them. Her feet seemed to touch the floor only every third or fourth step. People in the hall parted for the Mord Sith. Passers-by pressed themselves up against the walls to the side, a goodly distance away. Some people disappeared into the open shops from where they peered out windows. Everyone stared at the squat woman in the dark dress being hauled along by the two palace guards in burnished leather and gleaming mail. Behind, she could hear the jangle of metal gear as the rest of the men followed along. They turned into a small hall to the side, going back between columns holding a projecting balcony. One of the men rushed forward to unlock the door. Before she knew it, they'd all swept through the little door like wine through a funnel. The corridor beyond was dark and cramped, nothing like the marble-lined hallways most people saw. Not far down the hall, they turned down a stairway. The oak treads creaked underfoot. Some of the men handed lanterns forward, so Nida could light her way. The sound of all the footsteps echoed back from the darkness below. At the bottom of the steps, Nida led them through a maze of dirty stone passageways. The seldom-used halls smelled musty, and in places damp. When they reached another stairwell, they continued down a square shaft with landings at each turn, descending into the dark recesses of the people's palace. Anne wondered how many people in the past were taken by routes such as this, never to be seen again. Richard's father, Darkenrall, and his father before him, Panis, were rather fond of torture. Life meant nothing to men such as those. Richard had changed all that. But Richard wasn't at the palace now. Nathan was.
Anne had known Nathan for a very long time, for nearly 1,000 years. For most of that time, as prelate, she had kept him locked in his apartments. Prophets could not be allowed to roam free. Now, though, this one was free, and worse, he had managed to establish his authority in the palace, the ancestral home of the House of Rawl. He was an ancestor to Richard. He was a Rawl. He was a wizard.
Anne's plan suddenly started to seem very foolish. Just catch the prophet off guard, she'd thought. Catch him off guard and snap a collar around his neck. Surely there would be an opening, and he would be hers again. It had seemed to make sense at the time.
At the bottom of the long descent, Nida swept to the right, following a narrow walk with a stone wall soaring up on the right and an iron railing on the left. Anne gazed off over the railing, but the lantern light showed nothing but inky darkness below. She feared to think how far it might drop. Not that she had any ideas of a battle with her captors, but she was beginning to worry that they just might heave her over the edge and be done with her. Nathan had sent them, though. Nathan, as irascible as he could sometimes be, wouldn't order such a thing. Anne considered, then, the centuries she had kept him locked away, considered the extreme measures it had sometimes taken to keep that incorrigible man under control. Anne glanced over the iron rail again, down into the darkness. "Will Nathan be waiting for us?" she asked, trying to sound cheerful. "I'd really like to talk to him. We have business we must discuss." Nida shot a dark look back over her shoulder. "Nathan has nothing to talk to you about." At an uncomfortably narrow passageway tunneling into the stone on the right, Nida led them into the darkness. The way the woman rushed lent a frightening aspect to an already frightening journey. Anne at last saw light up ahead. The narrow passageway emptied into a small area where several halls converged. Ahead and to the right, they all funneled down steep stairs that twisted as they descended. As she was prodded down the stairs, Anne gripped the iron rail, fearful of losing her footing, although the big hand holding a fistful of her dress at her right shoulder would probably preclude any chance of falling, to say nothing of running off. In the passageway at the bottom of the stairs, Nida, Anne, and the guards came to a halt under the low-beamed ceiling. Wavering light from torches in floor stands gave the low area a surreal look. The place stank of burning pitch, smoke, stale sweat, and urine. Anne doubted that any fresh air ever penetrated this deep into the people's palace. She heard a hacking cough echoing from a dim corridor to the right. She peered into that dark hall and saw doors to either side. In some of the doors, fingers gripped iron bars in small openings. Other than the coughing, no sound came from the cells holding hopeless men. A big man in uniform waited before an iron-bound door to the left. He looked as if he might have been hewn from the same stone as the walls. Under different circumstances, Anne might have thought that he was a pleasant enough-looking fellow. "Nida?" the man said, by way of greeting. When his eyes turned back up after a polite bow of his head, he asked in his deep voice, "What have we here?" "A prisoner for you, Captain Lerner." Nida seized the empty shoulder of Anne's dress and hauled her forward as if showing off a pheasant after a successful hunt. "A dangerous prisoner." The captain's appraising gaze glided briefly over Anne before he returned his attention to Nida. "One of the secure chambers, then?" Nida nodded her approval. "Wizard Rawl doesn't want her getting out. He said she's no end of trouble." At least half a dozen curt responses sprang to mind, but Anne held her tongue. "You had better come with us, then," Captain Lerner said, "and see to her being locked in behind the shields." Nida tilted her head. Two of her men dashed forward and pulled torches from stands. The captain finally found the right key from a dozen or so he had on a ring. The lock sprang open with a strident clang that filled the surrounding low corridors. It sounded to Anne like a bell being tolled for the condemned. With a grunt of effort, the captain tugged the heavy door, urging it to slowly swing open. In the long hallway beyond, Anne saw but a couple of candles bringing meager light to the small openings in doors to each side. Men began hooting and howling like animals, calling vile curses at who might be entering their world. Arms reached out, clawing the air, hoping to net a touch of a passing person. The two men with torches swept into the hall right behind Nida, the firelight illuminating her in her red leather, so all those faces pressed up against the openings in their doors could see her. Her aegil, hanging on a fine chain at her wrist, spun up into her fist. She glared at the openings in the doors to each side. Filthy arms drew back in. Voices fell silent. Anne could hear men scurry to the far recesses of their cells. Nida, once certain there would be no misbehavior, started out again. Big hands shoved Anne ahead. Behind, Captain Lerner followed with his keys. Anne pulled the corner of her shawl over her mouth and nose, trying to block out the sickening stench. The captain took a small lamp from a recess, lit it from a candle to the side, and then stepped forward to unlock another door. In the low passageway beyond, the doors were spaced closer together. A hand covered with infected lesions hung limp out of one of the tiny openings to the side. The hall beyond the next door was lower, and no wider than Anne's shoulders. She tried to slow her racing heart as she followed the rough, twisting passageway. Nida and the men had to stoop, arms folded in, as they made their way. "Here," Captain Lerner said as he came to a halt. He held up his lantern and peered into the small opening in the door. On the second try, he found the right key and unlocked the door. He handed his small lamp to Nida and then used both hands to pull the lever. He grunted and tugged with all his weight until the door grated partway open. He squeezed around the door and disappeared inside. Nida handed in the lamp as she followed the captain in. Her arm, sheathed in red leather, came back out to seize a fistful of Anne's dress and drag her in after. The captain was opening a second door on the other side of the tiny room. Anne could sense that this was the room containing the shield. The second door grated open. Beyond was a room carved from solid bedrock. The only way out was through the door, and the outer room that contained the shield, and then the second door. The House of Rawl knew how to build a secure dungeon. Nida's hand gripped Anne's elbow, commanding her into the room beyond. Even Anne, as short as she was, had to duck as she stepped over the high sill to get through the doorway. The only furniture inside was a bench carved from the stone of the far wall itself, providing both a seat and a bed off the floor. A tin ewer full of water sat on one end of the bench. On the opposite end was a single folded brown blanket. There was a chamber pot in the corner. At least it was empty, if not clean. Nida set the lamp on the bench. "Nathan said to leave you this." Obviously, it was a luxury the other guests weren't afforded. Nida stepped one leg over the sill, but paused when Anne called her name. "Please give Nathan a message for me, please. Tell him that I would like to see him. Tell him that it's important." Nida smiled to herself. "He said that you would say those words. Nathan is a prophet. I guess he would know what you would say." "And will you give him that message?" Nida's cold blue eyes looked to be weighing Anne's soul. "Nathan said to tell you that he has a whole palace to run and can't come running down to see you every time you clamor for him." Those were almost the exact words she had sent down to Nathan's apartments countless times when a sister had come to her with Nathan's demands to see the prelate. "Tell Nathan that I have a whole palace to run and I can't go running down there every time he bellows for me. If he has had a prophecy, then write it down and I will look it over when I have the time." Until that moment, Anne had never truly realized how cruel her words had been. Nida pulled the door shut behind her. Anne was alone in a prison she knew she could not escape. At least she was near the end of her life and could not be held as a prisoner for nearly her entire life, as she had held Nathan prisoner for his. Anne rushed to the little window. "Nida?" The moored Sith turned back from the second door. From beyond the shield, Anne could not cross. "Yes." Tell Nathan that I'm sorry." Nida let out a brief laugh. "Huh. I think Nathan knows you're sorry." Anne thrust her arm through the door, reaching toward the woman. "Nida, please tell him. Tell Nathan that I love him." Nida stared at her a long moment before she pushed the outer door closed. Chapter 21. Kaelin lifted her head. She gently laid a hand on Richard's chest as she turned her ear toward the sound she'd heard off in the darkness. Beneath her hand, Richard's chest rose and fell with his labored breathing, but even at that she felt relief. He was still alive. As long as he was alive, she could fight to find a solution. She wouldn't give him up. They would get to Nikki. Somehow, they would get to her. A quick glance to the position of the quarter moon told her that she'd been asleep less than an hour. Clouds, silvery in the moonlight, had silently begun streaming in from the north. In the distant sky, she saw, too, the moonlit wings of the black-tipped races that always trailed them. She hated those birds. The races had been following them ever since Kara had touched the statue of Kalin that Nikki said was a warning beacon. Those dark wings were never far, like the shadow of death, always following, always waiting. Kalin recalled all too well the sand in that hourglass statue trickling out. Her time was running out. She had no actual indication of what would happen when the time that sand had represented finally ran out, but she could imagine well enough. The place where they had set up camp, before a sharp rise of rock with a stand of bristlecone pine and thorny brush to one side, wasn't as protected or tenable a camp as any of them would have liked, but Kara had confided that she was afraid that if they didn't stop, Richard wouldn't live the night. That whispered warning had set Kalin's heart to pounding, brought cold sweat to her brow, and swept her to the verge of panic. She had known that the rough wagon ride, slow as it had been while they made their way across open country in the dark, seemed to have made it more difficult for Richard to breathe. Less than 2 hours after they had started out, after Kara's warning, they'd been forced to stop. After they had stopped, they were all relieved that Richard's breathing became more even and sounded a little less labored. They needed to make it to Rhodes so that traveling would be easier on Richard, and so they could make better time. Maybe after he rested the night, they could make swifter progress. She had to fight constantly to tell herself that they would get him there, that they had a chance, and that the journey's purpose wasn't merely empty hope meant to forestall the truth. The last time Kalin had felt this helpless, felt this sense of Richard's life slipping away, she'd at least had one solid chance available to her to save him. She'd had no idea at the time that that one chance taken would be the catalyst that would initiate a cascade of events which would begin the disintegration of magic itself. She was the one who had made the decision to take that chance, and she was the one responsible for all that was now coming to pass. Had she known what she now knew, she would have made the same decision to save Richard's life, but that made her no less liable for the consequences. She was the Mother Confessor and as such was responsible for protecting the lives of those with magic, of creatures of magic, and instead she might very well be the cause of their end. Kalin sprang to her feet, sword in hand, when she heard Kara's whistled bird call to alert them to her return. It was a bird call Richard had taught her. Kalin slid the shutter on the lantern open all the way to provide more light. She saw Tom, hand resting on the silver-handled knife at his belt, rise from the nearby rock where he'd been sitting as he watched over both the camp and the man Kalin had touched with her power. The man still lay on the ground at Tom's feet where Kalin had ordered him to stay. "What is it?" Jensen whispered as she appeared at Kalin's side, hastily rubbing the sleep from her eyes. "I'm not sure yet. Kara signaled, so she must have someone with her." Kara walked in out of the darkness, and as Kalin had suspected, she was pushing a man ahead of her. Kalin frowned, trying to recall where she'd seen him before. She blinked then, realizing it was the young man they had come across a week or so back, Owen. "I tried to get to you sooner," Owen cried out when he saw Kalin. "I swear I tried." Holding him by the shoulder of his light coat, Kara marched the man closer, then yanked him to a halt in front of Kalin. "What are you talking about?" Kalin asked. When Owen caught sight of Jensen standing behind Kalin's shoulder, he paused with his mouth hanging open for an instant before he answered. "I meant to get to you earlier, I swear," he said to Kalin, sounding on the verge of tears. "I went to your camp." He clutched his light coat closed at his chest as he began to tremble. I saw all the remains. Dear Creator, how could you be so brutal?" Kalin thought Owen looked like he might throw up. He covered his mouth and closed his eyes as he shook. "If you mean all those men," Kalin said, "they tried to capture us, to kill us. We didn't collect them from their rocking chairs beside their hearths and bring them out into this wasteland where we slaughtered them. They attacked us. We defended ourselves." "But dear Creator, how could you?" Owen stood before her, unable to control his shivering. He closed his eyes. "Nothing is real. Nothing is real. Nothing is real." He repeated it over and over as if it were an incantation meant to protect him from evil. Kara forcibly dragged Owen back a bit and sat him down on a shelf of rock. eyes closed meditatively, he mumbled, "Nothing is real," to himself continually, while Kara took up a position to the left side of Kalin. "Tell us what you're doing here," Kara commanded in a low growl. Although she didn't say it, the "or else" was clear enough. "And be quick about it," Kalin said. "We have enough trouble and we don't need you added on top of it." Owen opened his eyes. "I went to your camp to tell you about it, but all those bodies." "We know about what happened back there. Now tell us why you're here." Kalin was at the end of her patience. "I'm not going to ask you again." "Lord Rawl," Owen wailed, tears bursting forth at last. "Lord Rawl, what?" Kalin demanded through gritted teeth. "Lord Rawl has been poisoned," he blurted out as he wept. Goose flesh prickled up Kalin's legs. "How can you possibly know such a thing is true?" Owen stood, clutching twisted wads of his coat at his chest.
"I know," he cried, "because I'm the one who poisoned him."
Could it be? Could it be that it wasn't really the runaway power of the gift killing Richard, but poison? Could it be that they had it all wrong? Could it be that it was all caused by this man poisoning Richard? Kalin felt her sword's hilt slip from her fingers as she started for the man. He stood, watching her come, like a fawn watching a mountain lion about to leap. Kalin knew there was something strange about this man. Richard, too, had thought there was something unsettling about him, something not quite right. Somehow, this quaking stranger had poisoned Richard. Richard barely hung to life. He was suffering and in pain. This man had been the cause of it all. Kalin would know why, and she would know the truth of it. Kalin closed the distance quickly. She would not risk his escape. She would not risk his lies. She would have his confession. Her hands started coming up toward him. Her power was recovered. She could feel it there, in the core of her being at the ready. This man had tried to kill Richard. She intended to find out if there was a way to save him. This man could tell her. She committed herself to taking him. It was not necessary for Kalin to invoke her birthright, but merely to withdraw her restraint of it. Her feelings about what this man had done faded away. They no longer mattered in this. Only the truth would serve her now. She was a being of raw commitment. He had no chance. He was hers. She saw him standing frozen, watching her come, saw his blue eyes widen, saw the tears running down his cheeks. Kalin felt the cold coil of power straining for release, demanding to be freed. As her hand rose toward this man who had harmed Richard, she wanted nothing so much as what she would have. He was hers. Kara abruptly jumped in between them. Kalin's sight of the man was blocked by the moored Sith. Kalin tried to brush Kara aside, but she was ready and firmly held her ground. Kara seized Kalin by the shoulders and forced her back 3 paces. "No, Mother Confessor, no!" Kalin was still focused on Owen, even if she couldn't see him. "Get out of my way!" "No, stop!" "Move!" Kalin tried to shove Kara aside, but the woman had her feet spread and couldn't be budged. "Kara!" "No, listen to me! Kara, get out of—" She shook Kalin so hard that Kalin thought her neck would snap. "Listen to me!" Kalin panted in rage. "What?" "Wait until you hear what he says. He came here for a reason. When he finishes, you can use your power if you want. Or you can let me make him scream until the moon covers its ears, but first we need to hear what he says." "I'll find out soon enough what he says, and I'll know the truth. When I touch him, he will confess every detail." "And if Lord Rawl dies as a result?" "Lord Rawl's life is hanging in the balance. We must think of that first." "I am. Why do you think I'm going to do this?" Kara pulled Kalin close to hear her whisper. "And what if using your power on this man kills him for some reason we don't yet even know about? Remember when we didn't know everything in the past? Remember Marlon Pickard announcing he had come to assassinate Richard? It was too easy then, and it's too easy this time. What if you're touching this man as someone's design, a trick with this man sent as bait of some sort? What if they want you to do it for some reason? What if you do what they intend you to do? Then what? It won't be a simple mistake that we can work to fix. If Lord Rawl dies, we can't bring him back. Kara's fierce blue eyes were wet. Her powerful fingers dug into Kalin's shoulders. What can it hurt to hear him first before you touch him? You can then touch him, if you still think it's necessary, but hear him first. Mother Confessor, as a sister of the Aegil, I'm asking you, please, for the sake of Lord Rawl's life, wait! More than anything, it was Kara's reluctance to use force that gave Kalin pause. If there was anyone who would be more than willing to use physical force to protect Richard, it was Kara. In the dim light of the lantern, Kalin studied the emotion in Kara's expression. Despite everything Kara said, Kalin didn't know if she could afford to take the chance to hesitate. What if it's a stab in the dark? Jensen asked from behind. Kalin glanced back over her shoulder at Richard's sister, at the worry on her face. Kalin had made a mistake before in not acting quickly enough, and it resulted in Richard's being captured and taken from her. Then it was his freedom. This time, it was his life at stake. She knew that while hesitation had been a mistake in that instance, that didn't mean that immediate action was always right. She looked back into Kara's eyes. All right, we'll hear what he has to say. With a thumb, she brushed a tear from Kara's cheek, a tear of terror for Richard, a tear of terror at the thought of losing him. Thanks, Kalin whispered. Kara nodded and released her. She turned and folded her arms, fixing Owen in her glare. You had better not make me sorry for stopping her. Owen peered about at all the faces watching him. Friedrich, Tom, Jensen, Kara, Kalin, and even the man Kalin had touched, lying on the ground not far away. In the first place, how could you possibly have poisoned Richard? Kalin asked. Owen licked his lips, fearful of telling her, even though that was apparently why he had returned. His gaze finally broke toward the ground. When I saw the dust rising from the wagon, and I knew that I was near, I dumped out what water I had left, so it would appear I had none. Then when Lord Rawl found me, I asked for a drink. When he gave me his water skin so I could have a drink, I put poison in it just before I handed it back. I was relieved that you had showed up, too. It was my intention that I poison both Lord Rawl and you, Mother Confessor, but you had your own water and didn't take a drink when he offered it to you. But I guess it doesn't matter. This will work just as well. Kalin couldn't make sense of such a confession. So you intended to kill us both? But you were only able to poison Richard? Kill? Owen looked up in shock at the very idea. He shook his head emphatically. No, nothing like that, Mother Confessor. I tried to get to you earlier. But those men went to your camp before I got there. I needed to get the antidote to Lord Rawl. I see. You wanted to save him after you'd poisoned him, but when you got to our camp, we'd gone. His eyes filled with tears again. It was so awful! All the bodies, the blood! I've never seen such brutal murder! He covered his mouth. It would have been murder, our murder, Kalin said, had we not defended ourselves. Owen seemed not to hear her. And you were gone, you'd left. I didn't know where you'd gone. It was hard to follow your wagon's trail in the dark, but I had to run to catch up with you. I was afraid the races would get me, but I knew I had to reach you tonight. I couldn't wait, I was afraid, but I had to come. The whole story was nonsense to Kalin. So, you're like one of those people who starts a fire, calls out an alarm, and then helps put it out, all so you can be a hero? Startled, Owen shook his head. No, nothing like that. Nothing like that at all, I swear. I hated doing it. I did. I hated it. Then why did you poison him? Owen twisted his light coat in his fists as tears trickled down his cheeks. Mother Confessor, we have to give him the antidote now or he will die. It's already so very late. He clasped his hands prayerfully and gazed skyward. Dear Creator, let it not be too late, please. He reached out for Kalin, as if to urgently beg her as well to assure her of his sincerity. But at the look on her face drew back. There's no more time, Mother Confessor. I tried to get to you earlier, I swear. If you don't let him have the remedy now, it will be the end of him. It will all be for naught, everything, all of it, all for nothing. Kalin didn't know if she dared trust in such an offer. It made no sense to poison a man and then save him. What's the antidote? She asked. Here. Owen hurriedly pulled a small vial from a pocket inside his coat. Here it is, please, Mother Confessor. He held the square-sided vial out toward her. He must have this now. Please hurry, or he will die. Or this will finish him, Kaelin said. If I wanted to finish him, I could have done so when I slipped the poison into his water skin. I could have used more of it, or I could simply not have come with the antidote. I'm not a killer, I swear. That's why I had to come in the first place. Owen wasn't making a whole lot of sense. Kaelin wasn't confident in such an offer. It was Richard's life that would be forfeit if she chose wrong. I say we give Richard Owen's antidote, Jensen whispered. A stab in the dark? Kaelin asked. You said that there were times when there is no choice but to act immediately. But even then it must be with your best judgment, using all your experience and everything you do know. Earlier in the wagon I heard Kara tell you that she didn't know if Richard would live the night. Owen says he has an antidote. I think this is one of those times we must act.
If it means anything, Tom offered in a confidential tone, I'd have to agree. I don't see as there really is any choice. But if you have an alternative that might save Lord Rawl, I think now would be the time to add it to the stew.
Kaelin didn't have any alternative except getting to Nikki, and that was looking more and more like no more than empty hope.
Mother Confessor, Friedrich offered in a hushed tone, I agree as well. I think you should know that if you let him have the remedy, we all were in agreement that it was the best choice to be made.
If the antidote killed Richard, they wouldn't blame her. That was what he was saying. Jensen stepped toward Owen, pulling Betty along with her. If you're lying about this being an antidote, you will have to answer to me and to Kara, and then to the Mother Confessor, if there's even anything left of you by then. You do understand that, don't you?
Owen shrank from her, his head turned away as he nodded vigorously, apparently fearing to look up at her or at Betty. Kaelin thought that he looked more afraid of Jensen than of any of the rest of them. Kara leaned toward Kaelin and whispered, He has to have an antidote. What purpose would it be to place himself in danger of all will do to him if he's lying? Why even come back here if he only wanted to poison Lord Rawl? He had already poisoned him and gotten away. Mother Confessor, I say that we give Lord Rawl the antidote and we do it quickly.
Then why poison him in the first place? Kaelin whispered back. If you intend to give a man the antidote, then why poison him?
Kara let out a frustrated sigh.
I don't know, but right now, if Lord Rawl dies...
Kara's words trailed off at the unthinkable. Kaelin looked over at Richard lying unconscious. She went weak at the thought of him never waking. How could she live in a world without Richard? How much do we give him? She asked Owen. Owen rushed forward past Jensen.
All of it! Make him drink it all down!
He pressed the small square-sided bottle into Kaelin's hands.
Hurry, please, hurry!
You've hurt him, Kaelin said with unrestrained menace. Your poison hurt him. He's been coughing up blood and he passed out from the pain. If you think I'll ever forget that and be pleased with you for now returning to save his life, you're wrong.
Owen nervously licked his lips.
But I tried to get to you. I was bringing you the antidote so that wouldn't happen. I never intended him such pain. I tried to get to you, but you slaughtered all those men.
So it's our fault then?
Owen smiled just a bit as he nodded, a small smile of satisfaction that she'd finally seen the light and at last understood that it wasn't his fault at all, but their fault. While Jensen watched Owen, keeping him back out of the way, Tom watched the man Kaelin had touched, and Friedrich watched Betty. Kaelin and Kara knelt and lifted Richard so they could try to get him to drink the antidote. Kara propped his back against her thigh while Kaelin cradled his head in her arms. She pulled the stopper with her teeth and spit out the cork. Careful not to spill and waste any of the antidote, she put the bottle to his lips and tipped it up. She watched it wet his lips. She tilted his head back more so that his mouth would fall open a bit and tipped the bottle some more. Carefully, she let some of the clear liquid dribble into his mouth. Kaelin didn't know if what was in the bottle really was an antidote. It was colorless and looked to her just like water. As Richard smacked his lips a little, swallowing what she had poured in his mouth, Kaelin smelled the bottle.
The liquid had the slight aroma of cinnamon. She dribbled more of it into Richard's mouth. He coughed, but then swallowed. Kara used a finger to swipe up a drop that ran down his chin and return it to his mouth. Kaelin, her heart pounding with worry, poured the rest of the liquid past his lips. Holding the empty bottle between her thumb and first finger, she used the palm of her hand to push Richard's jaw up, forcing his head back, forcing him to swallow. She sighed with relief when he swallowed several times, taking all the cure. At least she'd been able to get him to swallow it. Carefully, Kaelin and Kara laid Richard back down. As Kara stood, Owen rushed forward. "Did you give him all of it? Did he drink it all?" Kara's Ajeel spun into her fist. As Owen, in his exuberance to get to Richard, charged forward, Kara rammed her Ajeel into Owen's shoulder. Owen tottered back a step. "I'm sorry." He rubbed his shoulder where Kara had jabbed her Ajeel into him. "I only wanted to see how he is. I don't mean any harm. I want him to be well, I swear." Kaelin stared in astonishment. Kara glanced down at her Ajeel, then at Owen. Her Ajeel hadn't worked on him. He wasn't affected by magic. Even Jensen was staring at Owen. He was just like her. A pillar of creation, born pristinely ungifted and unaffected by magic. While Jensen understood what that meant, it didn't seem that Owen did. He had no idea that Kara had done anything more than poke him good and hard to get him to stand back. Her Ajeel should have dropped him to his knees. Richard drank all the antidote. "Now it must do its work. In the meantime, I think we had better get some sleep." Kaelin gestured with the tilt of her head. "See to the watches, would you, Kara? I'll stay with Richard." Kara nodded. She gave Tom a look which he understood. "Owen," Tom said, "why don't you come over by me and spend the night over here with this fellow?" Owen blanched at the look on the face of the big Daharan and understood that he wasn't being offered a choice. "Yes, all right." He turned back to Kaelin. "I'll pray that he got the antidote in time. I'll pray for him." "Pray for yourself," she said. When everyone had gone, Kaelin lay down beside Richard. Now that she was alone with him, tears of worry finally began to seep out. Richard was shivering with cold, even though it was a warm night. She drew the blanket back up around him, and then put her hand on his shoulder as she cuddled close, not knowing if when the new day came, he would still be with her. Chapter 22. Richard opened his eyes, only to squint at the light, even though it was far from sunny. By the layered streaks of violet tinting the iron-gray sky, it appeared to be just dawn. A heavy overcast hung low overhead. Or it could be sunset. He wasn't really sure. He felt strangely disoriented. The dull throbbing in his head ached back down through his neck. His chest burned with every breath he drew. His throat was raw. It hurt to swallow. The heavy pain, though, the pain that had squeezed so hard it had taken his breath and had made the world go black, seemed to have ebbed. The bone-chilling grip of cold had lifted, too. Richard felt as if he had lost contact with the world for a time. How long a time he didn't know. It seemed like it had been an eternity, as if the world of life was a distant memory from his past. He also felt as if he had come close to never waking again. It brought a flash of sweat to his brow to feel that he had been close to losing his life, to realize that he might never have awakened. The surroundings were different than those he remembered. Close by, a wall of straw-colored rock with sharp fractured edges rose nearly straight up. To the side, he saw a stand of twisted bristlecone pine. Pale, bare wood stood out in naked relief where sections of dark bark had peeled open. The imposing mountains loomed closer than he remembered, and there were more trees on the slopes of the nearby hills. Jensen lay curled up in a blanket beside Betty, her back against the rear wheel of the wagon. Tom was asleep not too far away, right beside his draft horses. Friedrich sat on a rock standing watch. Richard couldn't make sense of the two men who lay at Friedrich's feet. Richard thought one of them must be the man Kaelin had touched with her power. The other one, though, he wasn't sure of, although Richard thought there was something familiar about him. Kaelin was sound asleep up against him. His sword lay on his other side, close by his hand. On the other side of Kaelin lay her sword, sheathed, but at the ready. All the Seekers who had used the Sword of Truth before Richard, the good and the evil, had left within the sword's magic the essence of their skill. By mastering the sword as the true Seeker for whom the makers of the sword intended its power, Richard had learned to tap that ability and make it his own, to draw on all the skill and knowledge of those before him. He had become a master of the blade in more ways than one, and part of that had come from the blade itself. Kaelin had been taught to use a sword by her father, King Wyborn Amnal, once king of Galia before Kaelin's mother had taken him for her mate. Richard had completed Kaelin's training, teaching her how to use a sword in ways she had never been shown, ways that used her size and speed to her best advantage, rather than fighting like the enemy and depending on strength. Despite his pounding head and the pain when he drew a breath, the warm feel of Kaelin against his side brought him a smile. She looked so beautiful, even with her hair all in a tangle. She made his heart ache with longing. He had always loved her long, beautiful hair. He loved to watch her sleep almost as much as he loved to gaze into her arresting green eyes. He loved to make her hair a tangled mess. He remembered, back when he had first met her, watching her sleep on the floor of Addie's home, watching her slow heartbeat in the vein in her neck. He remembered, as he'd watched, being struck by the life in her. She was just so alive, so passionately filled with life. He couldn't stop smiling as he looked at her. Gently, he bent and kissed the top of her head. She stirred, nuzzling up tighter to him. Suddenly, she jerked upright, sitting on a hip as she stared wide-eyed at him. "Richard!" She threw herself down beside him, her head on his shoulder, her arm across his chest. She clutched him for dear life. A single gasp of a sob that terrified him with its forlorn misery escaped her throat. "I'm all right," he soothed as he smoothed her hair. She pushed herself up again, slower, gazing at him, as if she hadn't seen him in an eternity. Her special smile, the one she gave only him, spread incandescent across her face. "Richard!" She seemed only able to stare at him and smile. Richard, still lying back, trying to let his head clear, lifted an arm just enough to point. "Who is that?" Kaelin looked back over her shoulder. She turned back and took up Richard's hand. "Remember that fellow a week or so back, Owen? That's him." "I thought I recognized him."
"Lord Rawl!" Kara dropped to the ground on the side of him opposite Kaelin. "Lord Rawl!"
She, too, seemed to have trouble finding words. Instead, she took up his free hand. That in itself said a world to him. Richard took the hand back, kissed his first two fingers and touched the fingers to her cheek. "Thanks for watching out for everyone." Jensen hobbled over, the blanket still tangled around her legs.
"Richard, the antidote worked! It worked, dear spirits, it worked!"
Richard rose up onto an elbow.
"Antidote?"
He frowned at the three women around him.
"Antidote to what?"
"You were poisoned," Kaelin told him. She aimed a thumb back over her shoulder. "Owen. When he came to us the first time, you gave him a drink. In thanks, he put poison in your water skin. He intended to poison me with it, too, but only you drank it." Richard's glare settled on the men at Friedrich's feet, watching them. He nodded his confirmation that it was true, as if he should be commended for it. "One of those little mistakes," Jensen said. Richard puzzled at her.
"What?"
"You said that even you made mistakes, and even a little one could cause big trouble, don't you remember? Kara said you were always making mistakes, especially simple ones, and that's why you need her around."
Jensen flashed him a teasing smile.
"I guess she was right."
Richard didn't correct the story, but said as he stood, "It just goes to show how you can be taken by surprise by something as simple as that fellow over there." Kaelin was watching Owen.
"I have a suspicion he isn't so simple."
Kara put her arm out for Richard to grab hold of in order to steady himself.
"Kara," he said as he had to sit down on a nearby crate from the wagon,
"bring him over here, would you?"
"Gladly,"
she said as she started across their camp.
"Don't forget to tell him about Owen," Kara said to Kaelin.
"Tell me what?"
Kaylin leaned close as she watched Kara haul Owen to his feet. Owen is pristinely ungifted, like Jensen. Richard raked his hair back, trying to make sense of it. Are you saying that he's also my half-brother? Kaylin shrugged. We don't know that. We know only that he's pristinely ungifted. A wrinkle of puzzlement tightened on her brow. By the way, back at the camp where those men attacked us, you were about to tell me something important you figured out when we were questioning the man that I touched, but you never got the chance.
Yes, Richard squinted, trying to recall what the man had told them. It was about the one he said gave the orders sending him to capture us, Nicholas something.
The slide, Kaylin reminded him. Nicholas the slide.
Right. Nicholas told him where to find us, at the eastern edge of the wasteland, heading north. How could he know?
Kaylin mulled over the question. Come to think of it, how could he know? We've seen no one, at least no one we were aware of, who could have reported where we were. Even if someone had seen us by the time they reported our position and Nicholas sent the men, we would have been far from here unless Nicholas is close.
The races, Richard said. It has to be that he's the one watching us through the races. We've seen no one else. That's the only way anyone could have known where we were.
This Nicholas the Slide had to have seen us, to have seen where we were, through those birds that have been shadowing us. That's how he was able to give our location along with the orders. Richard rose as the man approached.
Lord Rawl, Owen said, arms spread in a gesture of relief as he scurried forward, Kara holding a fistful of his coat at his shoulder to keep him reined in.
I'm so relieved you're better. I never meant for the poison to hurt you as it did, and it never would have had you had the antidote sooner. I tried to get it to you sooner. I meant to, I swear I did. But all those men you slaughtered, it wasn't my fault.
He added a small smile to the pleading expression he gave Kaylin.
The Mother Confessor knows. She understands.
Kaylin folded her arms as she looked up at Richard from under her frown. It's our fault, you see, that Owen didn't make it to us sooner with the antidote to the poison. Owen got to our last camp intending to hand over the antidote to cure you, only to find that we had murdered all those men and then up and left. So it's not his fault. His intentions were good and he tried. We spoiled his effort. Very inconsiderate of us. Richard stared, not sure if Kaylin was giving him a sarcastic summation of what Owen had told her, or an accurate portrayal of Owen's excuse, or if his head still wasn't clear. Richard's mood turned as dark as the thick overcast.
You poisoned me, he said to Owen, wanting to be sure he had the man's story straight.
And then you brought an antidote to where we were camped, but when you got to that camp you came across the men who had attacked us, and you found we had gone.
Yes.
His cheer that Richard had it right abruptly faded.
Such savagery from the unenlightened is to be expected, of course.
Owen's blue eyes filled with tears.
But still, it was so.
He hugged himself and closed his eyes as he rocked his weight from side to side, from one foot to the other.
Nothing is real. Nothing is real. Nothing is real.
Richard seized the man's shirt at his throat and yanked him closer.
What do you mean nothing is real?
Owen paled before Richard's glare.
Nothing is real. We can't know if what we see, if anything is real or not. How could we?